Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, ho, 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 everybody. It's the NIDS View, produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies and a production of the NIDS Podcasting Network, where we're advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. In today's episode, we're keeping with the season and discussing a deterrence gift, just like the one I'm holding for those of you YouTube watchers. Yeah, we're discussing a deterrence gift from the National Nuclear Security Agency for the current stockpile. And what I'm speaking about is the December 16th announcement that the long-awaited W88 Alt-360 was completed, its last production unit. And we'll be discussing what this means for deterrence, along with a discussion about several other deterrence gifts that are in the works. But before that, let me introduce my ever-ready and absolutely prepared colleague, Curtis McGiffin, Vice President for Education and co-founder of NIDS. Curtis, what do you got to say?
It'll write a check that I can't cash here. I do want to remind our audience who may not actually be watching us on YouTube or Rumble that Jim is wearing a Santa hat. So he, when he says ho, 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 he is referring to the Christmas season. And not to anything else that might be running through your minds while you are sitting in traffic. So I just wanted to clarify that in this season of giving.
Well, thanks. Yeah, because we don't know what you're giving or getting out there. So we'll let it at that there, Curtis. Well, again, I told you he was ever ready and always prepared. So today we wanted to talk a little bit about an article that came out and a couple articles that came out, and we sort of looking through them. But I was really excited when I saw this NNSA announcement that came out on December 16th about the W88 nuclear warhead upgrade. It's been going on for years, and we're finally getting our last production unit. They usually refer to those as the LPU. They start out with an FPU, the first production unit, and the last production unit comes out. It doesn't add any nuclear weapons, but it does put the W88 out there. And one of the things I think is interesting with the announcement in today's world, because we've been getting a lot of discussion topics, people calling us, people asking us questions about testing. And I found that the W88 Alt-370 is a good example of a modern, modernized weapon that has gone through testing, testing in terms of its performance capability, et cetera, without, of course, nuclear weapon detonation testing and or explosive testing or some. So I thought I thought it was a good starting point. Oh, there's many other gifts to be had here to talk about it. But I just sort of lay the background. You know, basically the W88, you know, is an important weapon in our inventory. It's currently for the SLBM. It's put on a Trident II D5 missiles. It's fairly robust nuclear weapon, like 400. Or so kiloton weapon, or the unclassified information on that, I believe, or what's in the public, I guess I'd say. It's designed as a W88 for those of us in our needs. I'm sure you know, but maybe your friends don't. You know, it's basically 88 means it was built in the 1980s or designed and built in 1980s. And the main reason that weapon was built, and a really important piece about this weapon that is as good and bad, it was designed as a very compact nuclear weapon, which meant it could be MIRVed, or basically you could have multiple weapons on a single bus. And that's a great idea. I wish we used that idea to do something, because we don't MIRV our weapons right now. And so anyway, it's a great reliable weapon. And the upgrade, just to let everyone know, I've been involved in a little bit of the oversight on some components of this W88. It really wasn't about the pit. And so explosive testing really wasn't the main issue. It was about all the other components that go with it to modernize this weapon. Everything from the the firing unit to some of the grounding and safety components to it to make the weapon a little more reliable, reliable in terms of reliable in the environments that it'll be used in, a whole lot more safe, and shows that our capabilities are getting better and stronger and more usable as a deterrent because our adversaries will fear such a weapon. At least that's my opening salvo. I'm sure Curtis has a little more to say about that because he always doesn't like my glasses half full view of anything. Go ahead, Curtis.
Let me bring this up here. So this is 19. So this is a roughly still a 30-year-old weapon, right, Jim? This is essentially a 30-year-old car with new tires, a new battery. Maybe a new, we've changed out the fluids and maybe replaced the belts and hoses, put some new shocks and brakes. Important
things that make it go.
All important things that make it go and do the things that it needs to do. But in the end, it's still a retrofitted. You know, maybe we changed out the tape deck for a CD player in our 30-year-old car. And it's still, it might be a little more fun to drive and certainly a lot more trustworthy for a longer trip to grandma and grandpa's. But the reality here is this is still a 30-year-old weapon. I think it's a great, remarkable, a backslap for the NNSA and our labs and our ability to do this, to be able to take these older weapons and really make them almost, I stress almost, feel new again, right? Feel brand new again. But the reality is that we still continue to take a weapon that is the most dangerous, the most destructive known to man, at least kinetically. You could talk about some bioweapons that are pretty bad. But in any case, and still we entrust it onto this sort of these old platforms, right? These old under these old shells, around these older systems, and so I just think it's just a little bit of a commentary to this is great that we can continue to retrofit and modernize existing old systems. But when are we going to get to the point where we can build new systems? When are we going to revitalize or re-achieve our status as builders rather than just maintainers, Jim?
Well, Curtis, first of all, so you and I do see this completely different because I'm just going to tell you, you put new limited life components around it because the day after it's built, it's no longer brand new, by the way. And so when you put new limited life components on it, you put brand new explosive packages that are safer than what was there, new electronics around it. You know, what you're really talking about that you're saying is old and sort of, weary and leftovers is really the part that goes kaboom inside. And there's very little that change. There's things that change. I'm not going to tell you I'm not going to lead our audience the wrong direction. Things that do change. But regarding its capability of doing all the performance measures that it's designed to do, they're all still there. Whether it's 30 years old or 5 years old. I once was talking with an organization. I'll make a connection here, and then I'm going to turn the key a little bit differently. But what we have done is we've taken, not need to go back to the very beginning and start over again. We've taken something that works. It's still there. It's still doing its function because the function of the weapon is to do what? It's to deter. And that's what we want to make sure it does. And it does everything it's supposed to do. And our scientists have tested, validated it, confirmed it, and handing it off from the NNSA to the military to say it's going to do what it needs to do. At one time, I had someone that told me that they were working in a certain secure system, and they said, one of the problems we have right now is we have these old green phones, and this green phone is connected by a wire to another place, and that's the problem we have. We need to have a modern wireless phone for something. And then they said, and we need it to be, we needed a wireless phone with a wireless system that's brand new. And my answer is, why? A wired worked, and actually the components were able to be replaced with locally acquired equipment. New is not always better. However, in this case here, the parts that are new are in fact better than what was there. So we've made it better. So I'm just going to, I'll throw my piece there. But then I want to wait. I got to put another spin on this before you jump in. But also remember that this upgrade was only being done to satisfy the Curtis McGiffins, to be replaced someday by the W93, which is the next generation to be able to future Columbia class, you know, SSBNs, you know, and the design is the 2020s, you know, 93. So it is modern. It uses some of the same things, the insensitive high explosives. It has the enhanced security, the enhanced surety, the modular architecture. You know, all of these things here are to provide a foolproof solution to replace the W88s and the W76. So we're actually going to be able to broaden that with new things. And we're doing that too. So the NNSA is able to chew gum and walk at the same time.
Well, if the new one is not a weapon built circa 1993, then they ought to rename it. Okay. If you just described a weapon that's ultra modern, that's not 25 years old or 5 years younger than a W88. Yep. And so we probably ought to rename that.
I'm not into the naming world, you know, cause if I named them, I would name them the happy go lucky weapon. So we can just get out of it all together, you know, but that's not my call.
So let me ask you this, cause this is the question that's burning every listener. If you have FPU, and you have an LPU, mm-hmm. what is the three-letter designation for all the units in between the FPU and the LPU?
The IDK. I don't know.
Okay.
So there are interim units. You know, the process of testing and evaluation is an incredible process, Curtis. And I someday would love to walk you through that. The amount of analysis, you know, some people...
No, because then you'd have to kill me.
Well, maybe. but seriously, the process, though, for this analysis is an incredibly arduous process in which we're using very well-established scientific principles. And you test the physics so you understand what is happening from a physical standpoint. Some of these things are tested from the very smallest atomic level, broadened mm-hmm. out to an entire system. Much, much more important, because these systems do have to survive. I mean, you think about the incredible survivability environments that these things have to go through, not only in their deployment, but just in their use. You take a weapon, you take it out of a shelter, you put it into a submarine, you have it in a weapon system traveling around the world or whatever. It's got to be taken out for surveillance.
Yeah.
Got to be looked at. It's got to be put back in. And an aircraft, it might be flying high. These aren't. But if they're putting an aircraft, they have to fly high and come down. They go from a cold environment to a hot environment. They've got to be able to survive all those different environments. And these systems have to be able to endure all those changes, known and unknown, they're going to happen. And then they have to be deployed in a way that there could be an adversary who tries to interdict with a nuclear weapon or a conventional weapon and provide shock and radiation and heat and all of those things and still survive. And that, to me, is just an incredible piece. I used to always talk about our nuclear weapon evaluation and testing. I used to say, imagine if you were to sit around I'm probably going to feed into your lair here, Curtis, is I'm going to give you a 1950, Corvette Stingray, or I don't even know if I made Corvette Stingray back in. Anyway, a 1950 Chevy or Ford car. And I told you, you can't start it, put it in your barn and let it sit there for 40 years. And then suddenly there's a tornado coming. You're going to jump in the car. And while that tornado is hitting the barn, it's catching fire and you're getting hit by lightning and you have to start it and save yourself with it. That's sort of what has to happen. Oh, and you're never allowed to start it to check it out. Good luck.
This and sounds so like a terrible scenario.
It's very difficult.
Oh, my gosh.
What I'm saying is we've been doing this for years, and even in the underground testing scenario, my answer would be, if you took your car out and did all that with it, then after it worked for you, now put it all back together and stick it back in the barn and be ready to go, because that's what, you know, explosive testing is. We know that one worked, and, you know, that's what the testing's about, to validate that one. But the others are validated in all the testing beforehand.
Right. Well, I want to point out here, you know, some of the gifts that Santa has kept on giving us this year, and that is that the NNSA administrator Brandon Williams was quoted in this NNSA article from energy.gov, that the United States that also completed its B61-12 updates and its B61-13 work.
61?
B61, yes, 61, yes. So go do the math, folks. And he says here, quotes that what this proves is the United States has the will and the means to field newer, safer, and more capable warheads for our strategic deterrent. Jim, I don't know if you believe in Santa Claus, but this is truly a gift that no elf can pack. And no sleigh can carry that gift of what I call deterrence, which is also a gift of peace and security as we move forward. And that gift, believe it or not, is the least costly of all of the means of which to try to deliver peace and security. So I think all in all, that's a pretty nice gift from the NNSA folks and all the labs associated.
Who knows what's in the package here, though, Carrie, for those of you on the YouTube. Yeah, you know, you mentioned something I thought was really important here. And I was thinking about it as we're in the holiday spirit here. And people are, you know, out enjoying themselves. Again, deterrence allows you to do that. It allows you to go, you know, travel for the holidays, go home, have a meal, buy gifts, spend time with your family. It's very difficult to do that in wartime. I've been reading a bunch of books on how war starts, but then I've also been reading about the different aspects of war. And the holiday seasons were always a difficult time for our soldiers and sailors and airmen, you know, during wartime, because they're away from their families. But in places where that war is happening, you know, there is no peace. There is no freedom there because you have to, you know, obviously survive. And so when I was thinking about this, as I was reading about this one, I thought about deterrence. Deterrence is it's 24/7, 365 days a year. It has to happen every day, because the day that we don't have deterrence is the day it all changes. It's over. And so it was just sort of a somber moment thinking about it. Here at this great holiday season, think about it that way.
And while you're out
down here,
well, and while you're out spending and shopping and doing all the things, enjoying your Yuletide, our listeners can know, rest assured, it costs each American about 36 cents a day for that peace and security and stability and prosperity and all of that. So I think it's a real bargain as we consider what we do spend our money on with regard to war and intervention and other things like that. So all very good. Jim, there was a couple other pieces in this sort of, you know, we know that the president, we've already had a podcast on, you know, the president's, you know, edict to maybe perhaps start testing again in the future. We're not going to get into explosive testing today, but what we want to maybe breach is the idea that there's lots of testing going on. Jim, you've already hinted to that, and we do lots of different kinds of testing. And lots of other kinds of preparation as this modernization process continues. And there was a couple others, and one that's particularly interesting to me in the articles that you had for us to prep was this idea that the Air Force is accelerating the B-21 Raider stealth bombers production. And this was an Aero News Journal in very, very late November, but we're getting around to it now. And this is really,
we can do modern things.
So this is a good news story, right? Because the idea here is that in this piece is that, you know, we're trying to build a couple things. I found very interesting in this, Jim, is that the article says that Northrop Grumman is already assembling 40 airframes. That's the first number I've heard as to how far are we along in the construction process of these airplanes. Now, we don't know what level of construction that these airframes might be in. They could just be pieces of metal spread out on a warehouse floor all the way to a finished product that's getting buffed and waxed before it gets rolled out. So we don't know what level of condition, or if you will, of the development process that it's in, but there's 40.
Yeah, but I'm going to give our audience a homework assignment. I believe in a previous podcast, you mentioned you'd be happy if we had a certain number. I can't remember what it was. We talked about this once before back last summer, and now I need to go back. But maybe our audience will find it and will plug us on it, because I like to poke at you because you like to poke back at me. And you said something, but I don't think it was 40. I think it was like 25. If we even had 25, I'd be happy. But
I am very infamous for saying, we're 15 years into a 30-year modernization and we have yet to put any new metal on the runway. And guess what? That still holds today.
Yeah.
We may have some flying test models. There may be a number of models at different phases of construction within the process, but that does not mean we have combat ready units today. Now, this article goes on to say, though, that the Air Force is surging money. Congress surged about $4.5 billion in July of 2025 to deliver combat units by the mid-2020s. Jim, I'm a simple liberal arts guy, but my look at the calculator and the calendar is we're in the mid-2020s. Yeah. And we don't have it yet, but you know what? I'm gonna try not to be overly critical in this season of goodwill, and I'm gonna remain hopeful on all of that. One last thing I wanted to note in the same article, Jim, that you pulled out, and it was that in the last paragraph it says that ultimately Air Force is racing to crank out more of these B-21s to lead in this technological primacy, this race for power, a balance of power, and that it signals resolve to adversaries while empowering allies through potential exports like Australia's ongoing evaluations. So this article is telling me that there is Australia is evaluating perhaps acquiring the B-21. This is something that we here at NIDS has been advocating for months and months and months. We even talked about it recently in a HUSI event with the release of our nuclear posture review. And my gosh, apparently this has been going on or might be going on. So I'd like to think that, Jim, we maybe are a little prophetic in all of this.
We are. And, I saw the same thing because we had started talking about this even before we started talking about the upgrade in the NPR. We talked with some of our Deterrence Down Under folks about this and how we can partner with, and we've been using both Australia and South Korea as two places where I think we do need to have cross-platform capabilities that end up shoring up areas where we're not burdened by everything. We have some partnership in it. We have some shared burden in that work. And that was one of the things that I thought, I thought was really interesting in coming out in this article. Mm-hmm. Again, what a gift, and a gift not only that keeps giving for America, but gives back to NIDS a little bit of what we thought of first, right? So, I'm glad someone out there is listening.
Good luck convincing Northrop Grumman that we thought of that first. Okay. That's awesome. You also had an article, Jim, that you picked out here on the Columbia-class submarine and its status.
Hey, so as we're kind of
so we don't want to forget our brothers and sisters in the fleet, and so there was as Congress stuck in $4.5 billion to speed up the B-21 production, they did $2.3 billion for the Navy to speed up the purchase and construction of five Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines, which have been plagued by cost overruns and delays, per the article here, which is Allison Bath and Stars and Stripes, came out again in late November of 2025. And that the Navy's been on contract now to build 12 Columbia-class submarines to replace 14 Ohio class. So it's not a one for one swap, Jim. We're actually going with fewer submarines. Yeah. And so that's in my simple mind, that is a reduction in capability. Now, if you can keep more submarines out at sea and have a different ratio than what you had under the Ohio, well, then I can be convinced that maybe while it's fewer in numbers, it's the operational availability is the same. I haven't seen those numbers. I'm not privy to it, so I can only calculate with the raw numbers. There are three submarines, I guess, that are two that are under construction, and the one planned. The first one's going to be the USS District of Columbia, then the USS Wisconsin, and then the third one, which is supposed to start, I guess, next year, which is right around the corner, is the USS Groton. And the first one, the USS District of Columbia, has already been delayed, is now delayed 17 months. Interesting to note, Jim, again, I'm a simple math kind of guy. You're a very quadratic equation kind of scientist guy, but I look at this and I say, equation. I can't spell it, but I have a decent understanding of what it might be. And that is, it costs $16 billion for one of these submarines. That's the equivalent of 22 B-21 bombers, mm-hmm. which is running about $700 million per bomber. I'm sure these numbers are probably underestimated, so we'll assume the ratios remain pretty close. I'm not saying that that's a bad purchase or not. They serve different roles. They have certainly different purposes. They're meant to complement one another. I'm just simply conveying that a single submarine is equal to about a squadron of bombers and for what it is that they can and can't do. I just find these numbers interesting to me. There was a report from the Government Accounting Office in 2023, Jim, that warned that the Navy didn't have the statistical analysis needed to ensure that the Columbia-class submarines would be ready on time to fulfill their nuclear deterrent role. Now, I don't know if since 2023 the Navy has figured that out. One would hope that in the two years following that GAO report that they have. But, you know, I hear many rumors. And, Jim, you know the thing about rumors, right? Most are wrong, some are right. And so I hear rumors that the Columbia is, while it is the most expensive and on paper the most important acquisition project for the Navy, it's probably one that they're not most interested in, right? They're thinking about a war with China. They're thinking about they need more combatant ships to be out there, you know, being ready to duke it out with the PLAN, and no one expects that the SSBNs will be out there doing that. But what, again, this comes to my argument in the past, Jim, that arming for deterrence is different than arming for war, and when we're prioritizing war fighting versus prioritizing war prevention. And this is two different philosophies, and I think it's one that some in our services are still maybe don't quite, don't quite embrace, and for whatever reason. And so I just like to just point that out here as we're thinking about here in our Christmas season of peace and goodwill, and we espouse that deterrence is the fastest way to peace. We should probably be concentrating on building arming for deterrence and peace rather than the other way around. So just a couple observations there. I'll pass it back to you.
Yeah, Curtis, I don't disagree with that, but I do say you need to have, you know, a multitude of ways in which you deter, you know, whether it be, you know, that's why the triad is so important. So I see, you know, the great value here. In fact, it sort of fits my, what do I call it? The Curtis McGiffin whack-a-mole theory. You give them enough moles to whack at, and basically they're like, I'm not doing this anymore. I do think that in the future, we need to start looking. These numbers get thrown around. Americans almost become numb to the concept of, Well, it's $126 billion. I mean, we're numb to $38 million or trillion dollars in debt. Like, oh, that's just 38. That's a number. You know, we do have to find a way in which we can bring these costs down, or at least, like you said, be able to say we've done the math and this is what we need to deter. And it's, you know, defining what you need to deter, and you and I have gone back and forth on this, even on this podcast, and I think once or twice even in a classroom where someone says, what do you need to deter? And I said, well, I can answer that as long as you look in the past, because I know what we deterred in the past. Mm-hmm. And so it worked. Right. And we had, you know, 20,000 nuclear weapons at one time, strategic nuclear weapons. And that's what it took to deter. How do I know? Well, we never got into a major power war during that time. So that's what it took. Maybe one less wouldn't have. I don't know. You can't go back and tell. It's a very difficult piece to do. And so as you look at this critically, I don't disagree with you. I think it's a smart way to look at this. What are we trading in one port for another? Because money and effort and time, those three things are really tied together. They are not interchangeable. And when war breaks, you pretty much have what you got, right? And right. So you don't want war. You want deterrence. You want to maintain the peace. And so that is a worthwhile debate. I just think that my issue on the bombers, you know, one, we have first of all, the submarines. It's nice to have a nice modern submarine to fly around our nearly modernized nuclear weapons. I'm just poking at you from the beginning here. Okay. And, you know, that are all functional and doing what they're supposed to do. But I am a strong advocate for rebuilding our bomber fleet to the point where we have planes in the air and sufficient pilots and maintainers and security to keep them in the air, to have a bomber fleet flying, because that is, there's something about those bombers flying overhead that really is a signal to everyone that we mean business, and everyone knows that.
Yeah, I agree with you. The bombers are the most visible of the triad, the most flexible of the triad, and that flexibility comes from our ability to project them, to message with them, to recall them. You can put them on alert and escalate as a message of escalation. You can take them off alert as a message of de-escalation. So there's plenty of things that can be done, but you've got to have them. You've got to have working versions of them, and you have to have enough that you can have be able to maintain an alert force, which we here at NIDS have been advocating for and do again in our recent nuclear posture review. Go to our website and check it out. And still be able to utilize the bombers in whatever conventional role that the nation requires for other mechanisms. You know, going back to the B-21, you know, there's now with this B-21 is some modernizing of the footprint, right? We were going to put them at bases that haven't had a nuclear mission in a couple of decades. And so there is a lot of work. There was an article that just came out here a few days ago from one of the local news stations in Abilene, right around Dyess Air Force Base, that sort of described a big effort that's going on there to prepare for their B-21 fleet, which is, I think, going to be the last base to get them. But the work is now getting ready to start. They've got to build new hangar facilities. They've got to build more new ramp facilities, new fueling facilities, weapon storage. They say that they need more. They need a bigger security force. They call it a security force campus. Maybe that's an enterprise. More people, more training, more places for them to be. Maybe a bigger snack bar and these sorts of things. But the most part is, you know, when you have these new stealth bombers, they've got to be defended, protected, and whatnot. I didn't read in any of all of this work is an effort to build hardened shelters to protect these bombers from drone attacks and other things that would be devastating should they occur here in this country. There is no safe haven anymore. The United States is not going to be immune from attacks right on its ramp, whether they be cyber, or kinetic in some way. And after watching Ukraine prosecute drone attacks on Russia's strategic bomber force, we should be going through great measures. I think I've advocated in the past, Jim, and I'll remind our listeners again, because you never know who's listening for the first time, that every bomber should come with a budget line that includes a hardened hangar at wherever it's going to be. so there is a place to park it where it cannot be seen and it can't be attacked.
Well, there's one other piece of that, and that is even the softer part of that. And that is a hardened facility for the personnel, as well as more personnel. You know, you spread your aircraft out. Mm. You know, the whole idea of the base realignment stuff is that, oh, you consolidate everything in one spot, right, and it's cheaper to secure. Yeah, but you're also a bigger target and an easier target.
Yes.
You spread things out, you need more security. You need more maintenance facilities, new, more administrative facilities. And I don't see that ever go with the budget line. And that's why I think sometimes you need to look at these things as what I think of as modular units, okay? And they've got to come with the module. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any of that. Maybe it's something we'd talk about in the future. Here.
Yeah, I like that thought, because we really need to be thinking about distributed operations. What are we going to do with bombers? Should we put them back on alert? You may not want to put them on alert at the main base, which is a main target.
Yes.
If the purpose of having a jet on alert is to survive it, then you probably want to get it away from the prime targets. So you want to have alternate operating locations. You need to make sure those are going to be properly prepared for the new bomber and secure against the same kinds of threats. So, yeah, you may literally have to build not only a hangar at its main base, but a hangar for a small number of bombers that might need to be at a distributed base somewhere else within the United States in order to enhance their survivability by adding complicating the targeting picture, should you to be I guess a little more clear in what I'm trying to say here of the adversary. I don't want the adversary to know that I only have to attack, you know, three or five bomber bases. We need to make that you're going to have to attack 10 or 12 if you plan on taking out the whole fleet, and that obviously makes that a much harder problem. And when you make those problems harder, then you increase the likelihood of what I always refer to, Jim, as deterrence by futility, yeah, right? This just isn't going to be worth, this juice isn't worth the squeeze. Let's not bother doing it in the first place.
The Curtis McGiffin whack-a-mole theory.
There it is.
There you go. Hey, Curtis, I hate to tell you this. I mean, we could just get in this discussion, and we do it a lot, you know, on the side, but we can't do it here on the podcast because we promise our listeners. Yeah.
Well, you picked out some good articles, Jim. This was a good one.
Yeah, well, and we never got to one. You know, we talked about all the new things, and I deliberately, this last one, this Y-12, you know, another gift is the, and I'm not going to get to it, is why Y-12 is downgrading one of their nuclear facilities built in 1944, because sometimes you got to give up something and stop maintaining it. It tells us that we're moving on, which actually
I think you got to trim the fat where you can, right?
And we're moving on from where we were, and we're moving on to the modern, and I think that's a telltale. But I'll let our listeners see it. But it is an article that came out of the Department of Energy on the 9th of December. Y-12 downgrades nuclear facility built in 1944. Mm-hmm. Read it, and in terms of a deterrence, like, what are we signaling in doing this? Like, well, we're not doing it the old way anymore. Now, hopefully we're going to do it the new way, because we're not doing it at all. That's a different problem. But I don't think that's the message it leaves. And so, you know, safety, security, modernization, and above all else, deterrence really matters. So, Curtis, here in this giving season, I want to give you an applaud.
And a thank well, you. Thank you.
for this grand discussion. And same thing to Kimberly, who's behind the scenes right now doing this, and to our audience and supporters and all the people that listen to us. Listen to this podcast, share it with your friends, share it with anyone you can, because as always, we want you to think about these things and also to think deterrence.
There it is.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.